Well, then second or third hand testimony, and so then we can get into, you know, Joseph Smith's first hand testimony, the ancient prophets. But then even more pertinent is to people today who are living right now who can say, I saw Jesus Christ, you know, I experienced him firsthand. And those are testimonies.
One of the things we need to remember, I think, is Joseph Smith did not ever say, I talked to God, so you gotta do what I say. He said, he approached it the way Jesus did. He said, you ask, you seek, you knock, that's in the early revelations.
Uh-huh.
God will show you directly. And that kind of experience that Joseph had still happens in the church. We still have people who pray about which church to join.
Mm-hmm.
And Jesus appears to them in person and directs them into our midst.
Mm-hmm. You must have been reading my notes here, because the very next slide, I think, leads right into that. Do you think, this is again from us to somebody who's a non-believer, do you think the scientific method could be applied to finding out the truth of whether God exists? If so, would you be willing to conduct the experiment? And this is just what you said, Joseph Smith, you know, said, you know, it's not just me. You can go out and get your own experience. Pray about it, seek the Lord, and he'll tell you. And so the hypothesis is there is a God, and that those who seek him with all their hearts, with a desire to believe, will find. That's the scientific hypothesis, you might say. Well, if we act on that hypothesis, can we prove that it's true or false? We've got to actually do it. And Jesus actually said that. What is it he said? If you... something that you know the truth of what I say if you do them. It's in John. I can't remember the exact verse, but those who keep my commandments will know of their truth, or keep my words will know of their truthfulness. I believe there is something of that. The seed experiment in Alma 16, plant the seed and make an attempt to seek God, and you will find. Well, if we believe that's true, then that's one of the answers we need to give to somebody is, it's, I can't just tell you about it. You've got to go out and experiment on it, because that's how you find truth. So another answer, and again, I'm getting back to the original question, was, you know, well, evolution is a proven fact of science, so therefore there is no God. Well, that's a non sequitur. It does not follow from the argument to the conclusion, because there are many different answers given by Christian believers in dealing with the scientific evidences. One of those answers is, God created the universe 6,000 years ago in 6 24-hour days, and all the scientific evidence for an old Earth is wrong. That's one answer. But there are many other answers out there that believing committed Christians also hold. God created the universe through a Big Bang 17 billion years ago, as evidenced by science and by Genesis 1. And you'll find they'll go through Genesis 1 and show, here's the sequence of the creation over a extended period of time. It has pluses and minuses, but I'm just presenting that these are different viewpoints. Many Christians believe that God worked through evolutionary processes, but it was still his divine providence that was causing it to come about. Another answer is the intelligent design argument, which is the complexity in nature is an evidence of intelligent design. Therefore, if there's design, there must have been a designer. And of course, that intelligent design kind of goes... Wait a minute. Why are my notes not... Oh, yeah, I skipped one, that's why. Let me go on to that one. So I skipped down to 5. Going back up to 4, another answer that some Christians hold is that the early chapters of Genesis represent religious and moral writing, but they weren't intended to be a precise scientific textbook on the exact, you know, scientific process of creation. It was more of a presentation that God is the creator, but not necessarily something we can take to the physics classroom or the chemistry classroom and actually work out the scientific details. And again, that's another viewpoint that's held by Christians. And so the only point in bringing this up is, just because somebody accepts the scientific evidence for evolution doesn't mean that they necessarily have, or an old Earth, doesn't mean that they necessarily have to be led to the conclusion that there is no God. There are other options for, you know, taking the scientific evidence and coming to different conclusions. So therefore, it's not a logical argument to proceed that direction.
Well, number five then sort of responds to all of that. It encompasses whatever.
Right. Yeah. The intelligent design really encompasses old Earth creation, young Earth creation, everything. The basic point there is that God is a designer. That doesn't say how he designed or how he made the process happen.
Nor does it argue against any particular process. Mm-hmm. We don't always have to know the specifics, although there are some things that are just absolutely ludicrous that are put out there. Mm-hmm. Well, on both sides, or any side, whether you're a believer or a non-believer.
Mm-hmm. And so each of these viewpoints, and these are Christian viewpoints, boasts of scientific evidence in their favor. And I say none of them has been proven conclusively as the answer to all of the scientific and theological questions. You know, I've kind of given a spectrum from the young Earth down to the other, and frankly, I'm not quite satisfied with any of them because there's all these questions that can't be resolved in one viewpoint, that there are questions that are very difficult to resolve, and if you go to another viewpoint, it has a good answer, but then some of the other questions are very difficult to resolve. It's a very difficult question, but suffice it to say that there are strong scientific objections to evolution, at least the full atheistic version of evolution, anyway, which the scientific community refuses to acknowledge to the general public. And that's... What's that? Go ahead. Go ahead.
Well, I was just wondering if you could give an example of where scientific evidence of evolution is. What is it? Give me an example.
I can give you lots of them if you want. Okay, well, you got to look at, first of all, what evolution actually says.
Yeah,
okay, yeah?
Make it so I can understand.
That's fine. We're not in one, and we could have a whole class on this, or a whole, actually, like a semester-long series on this, but so just to be warned. You know, one problem with our argument is we sometimes mix up evolution with Big Bang Theory, with origin of the universe. Evolution only deals with the origin of species. You know, so first of all, you've got to have something to work with in order for evolution to have anything to do. And so evolution basically says that species change over time, and that over time those species diverge to the point that they can no longer, you know, mate with each other, and they basically continue to diverge on branching, you know, differences essentially over time. And that's really the bottom line of what evolution says. There are tons of examples of seeing it in practice. I mean, one really interesting example is where, you know, some Christians say that there are no new species. You know, you can't create new species. Well, it happens all the time. You see, let's say one real interesting example is around a lake, let's say, you know, or a big body of water, you have a species, a bird, and then you go out from there and you see them over time changing. And sometimes it actually makes a full circle back to where the species actually meet up again on the other side, and at that point they can no longer mate with each other. You know, they've changed so much, there's a gradual progression of species, so that everywhere along the way they can mate with each other, but then when you get them together, they're different. They're completely different species, and if at some point you lose the other ones, you would end up with two sets of species right here that are different. They've now progressed from one common species to two different ones that are going to then carry on independently of each other. There's lots of different things, you know, from the fossil evidence is where it started, back in the 1800s. The biological evidence, you know, showing the differences and commonalities of species, but then all of that basically led to a sort of a view of the branching tree of you know, different species. Well, then you had genetics that came along, and genetics could have said, if we look at the DNA of these two different, you know, different sets of animals, we might completely have a different viewpoint of how their relatedness or unrelatedness are. But the DNA evidence, you know, shows that those that were thought to be similar were actually similar genetically, and those that were further away are actually further away genetically. And I could, you know, give a lot of other examples, but I'm just saying that there are, you know, reasonable evidences out there that of many of the points that are held as far as evolution. And I could give you some more details, but I see two hands over here. Well, Rita, you haven't said anything today. Go ahead.
Well, I, I was organization.
Oh, I thought you had your hand up.
An interesting thing in accordance with what you're saying uh-huh. is that mankind now has involved themselves in evolution, and that the way they cross-pollinate plants and they cross-breed animals like cattle and sheep and mm-hmm. to get a better breed, see? Mm-hmm. And the old breeds that they used to use, they don't use any longer because the new ones are better. Mm-hmm. And that's a form of evolution that mankind is involved in.
And that was where Charles Darwin started with his thing of the artificial breeding, and then he looked at nature and saw some of the same things happen. But there are examples of, you know, new and improved features that you can actually see over time. So sometimes we think that genetic differences lead to, it's always a problem and it's always a negative thing. Well, there are examples of positive changes, you know, genetically.
If you're going to develop a better species, you got to know what causes it. Mm-hmm. And the studies that they've gone to the universities and things have helped them understand this and cause crossbreeding, cross-pollination, mm-hmm. and then watching the bees, you know.
Mm-hmm.
They do a good job.
Yeah.
I'm going to try to build upon your foundation, but bring you along to the truth, John.
Okay.
I think within those birds on one side of the shore, there was genetic diversity already within that species to develop. By the other side of the lake, being different in form, so they couldn't breed together, but it was still a bird, and mm-hmm. it wasn't a man.
Exactly. So that's where you have to go back, you know, the actual, you know, change from major, the level is you've got species, you've got phylums, you've got kingdoms, you know, where do you draw the line? And you could have, that's where you have to take it back historically and see, is there evidence for phylums diverging? Is there evidence for, you know, those kind of things? And there's certainly evidences on both sides of that whole question. And this isn't the place I'm going to try to debate the whole the whole question, but Bruce?
I'm no authority on this. I want to share a very brief conversation. My brother's a department head of a molecular biology at a major university. He thinks evolution is for real. And he said, I said, well, why do you think that? He said, well, we have like 98% of the genes of a chimpanzee. We have 90% of the genes of a mouse. Mm-hmm. He didn't say that. I said that. Well, we have 90% of the genes of a mouse in our human bodies. We also conserve a whole bunch of the genes that are in bacteria. So he said, yeah, that shows we evolved from bacteria. I said, well, I told my brother, I said, I go out and open the door of my Chevy van, built in 1995. There's a specific door latch and a door lock on there. And it's identical to the door latch that was in my 1980 Chevy sedan. I said, I think out in some junkyard somewhere, there was a bolt of lightning and my van evolved from that other Chevy sedan. He said, no, they were just built by the same company. I said, that's my point. The same designer that built the bacteria built the chimpanzee, and he also, because he had a good set of basic tools and parts, he built us and our bodies from the same.
Right, and that's the common designer argument.
Yeah.
Is
the door latch didn't fall, it was the same designer.
Right, I agree.
I like that illustration that Bruce just used. Let me give a little different take on this. Evolution is the product of the scientific method. Scientific method, you make an assumption or a hypothesis, and then you attempt to prove that through experimentation. Charles Darwin identified the two hypotheses that evolution is built on in the introduction to his book, The Descent of Man. Those two hypotheses are, number one, change is eternal. Specifically states that in there. Change is eternal. The second thing upon which evolution is built is that change is always for the better.
Right? Now, is that what he said in there? Is that what he said in there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Science has destroyed the second hypothesis at this point. So we have to deal with the first hypothesis. Is change eternal? Well, we happen to believe in a God who is unchangeable. And the question, of course, that we have to face is in Genesis, the sixth chapter, verse 66, I believe it is, God says there that all things are made and created to bear witness of me. So how can a changeable theory bear witness of an unchangeable being? That's the issue. A compatriot or an individual who appeared, that's the way I say it, of Darwin's was John Muir, the famous naturalist. He proposed a similar theory, not based upon the scientific method, but based on his observations, and it was not based on competition as Darwin's evolutionary theory was. It was based on cooperation. And what you see that's come out of Muir's work is, of course, the National Park System, which has been preserved for all of us to go and do what? Observe, make observations, make our own conclusions. This whole area is really interesting to get into, and I do have a few opinions on it. But
go ahead. Deal, right?
Also, man's hand in a evolutionary process doesn't extend strictly to animals and plants. How about chemistry? Get the chemicals that are there, that exist, and we learn how to use them to make better things. Plastics, paints, whatever. See, things that didn't exist 50 years ago. And so it goes, and so it goes.
Yeah. And it does keep going and keep going, and if we take too much more time on the subject, we'll have to invite me back next month to finish. But we'll try to get to carry on here a little bit more, a little further.
Well, John, for you, I will no longer say I don't see how somebody can believe in God and still believe in evolution. I at least have opened my mind enough to see that people can argue that conclusion.
Yeah, I mean, one other quick point, you know, not just the, as Bruce mentioned, the similarity of the chimpanzee, but it's like, for instance, you have the 22 chromosomes, 23 chromosomes in us versus the chimpanzees, and the one that they find that is where they have two and we have one, there's obviously evidence that they were fused together, that they used to be two, and that you can see evidence where there were two, and you know, a midpoint there where they were joined together. And so that's why they say it's not just the fact that we're similar. You know, a Ford and a Chrysler are real similar, but they didn't evolve from each other. But you know, in other cases, there are genetics that like that are used as evidences as well. So anyway, and again, none of that proves that it's all true. It just proves that potentially there is evidence for certain parts of the theory or certain you know, explanation for the evidence. But go ahead.
The important part is
none of it proves that it's by happenstance, because you've got to have something to, before you can, you know, to go from nothing to something, something's got to happen there. Right.
Well, that's why, to me, evolution never really did affect my belief one way or the other. Mm-hmm. I kind of believe in the fossil record. Maybe the carbon dating's wrong, but yeah, I believe in it because I can feel it, I can touch it. Doesn't mean that God didn't create.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly my point. Let me go ahead and move on from that, because that is really my point here, is we're trying to, you know, how do I do this? Escape. How do you do escape on this? Oh wait, I'm pointing the wrong direction anyway.
Try this clicking next, see if that'll
know. If I knew how, oh, there we go. Yes. But what button do I click for the, oh yeah, that's that.
Select.
Right mouse button, there we go. And also I want to acknowledge that many creationist arguments are flawed as well, or at least not as conclusive as what they like to admit. And this is what we need to be careful too, is not taking a very narrow view of the Christian creationist view and say, oh, this is absolutely true, and then when we find out that foundation keeps getting knocked out from underneath us, we may get into a problem. And if we've based our faith on Christian theories rather than you know, that are contrary to evidence, that becomes a problem as well, and I don't have too much time to deal with that one. In fact, for Faith Builders a different year, I did a class on the science question, so a whole class on it, and even then just skimmed the surface. Our faith in God isn't dependent on any one of these theories being proven or disproven. The most important evidence, experience, is beyond science. Our experience with God, our faith and our relationship with God, that testimony is something that science can't even touch, can't even speak to, because it's not scientific. It's, you know, it's experiential. And again, the most important thing to remember is, as our brother said there, is that there is a God and He is our Creator. The foundation of truth rests on the belief in God's supremacy. His act of creation, the agency and fall of man, and God's ultimate plan of redemption, that's the essence of the gospel, and everything else, these are all side questions, subsidiary questions to how God might have created. And of course, again, I've been using Ammon and the sons of Mosiah as sort of a theme here, that Ammon began at the creation of the world and told him all things concerning the fall of man, the plan of redemption, and made known unto them concerning the coming of Christ. And so, you know, he could have stayed all in the creation and spent all of his time there, but never gotten to the coming of Christ. And that's where we need to be careful to focus the message back to back to the gospel, instead of getting tied up in these side questions. I've got a few things to say, obviously, about creation evolution. I've got a few more before I'm done here. Before passionately defending any of the various theories, Christian or otherwise, on creation, consider this question. Assuming there is a God who created all things and established moral laws governing mankind, does our faith depend on understanding how He actually created the physical universe? As long as we know that He did it, do any of these particular theories matter as far as, you know, depending on, you know, if there is a God, there isn't a God? That's really the big question. How He chose to create, or to, you know, how long He took to do it, are really not fundamental to our faith. And, or at least I would argue that they shouldn't be necessarily, because, you know, those are mechanisms basically, and God can do however He wants. And through faith, we understand that the worlds were framed by the Word of God, so that things which are seen were not made of things that do appear. Or it also could be read, things which are seen were made of things which are invisible, and science has kind of shown that to be true too, that invisible things make up the solid matter that we see in the creation. And finally, I said, for further study on this, I've listed several different websites out there. The ASA, American Scientific Association, is an association of Christians of all different stripes on this subject. And of course, you have Answers in Genesis. Reasons to Believe is an old Earth creation organization, and Discovery Institute is promotes intelligent design. So they all have, you know, resources and materials out there, and I've just presented those for information. One more point before we move on is considering this. Many Christians get tied up in the first chapter of Genesis, arguing 7 24-hour literal days, or you know, long periods of time over billions of years. The Inspired Version kind of gives us a different view on that by talking about Genesis 1 represents a spiritual creation. That kind of cuts, almost automatically cuts out all of the, you know, young earth creation, old earth creation debate in Genesis 1, because we don't have to worry necessarily about a literal creation, physical creation at all, according to the Inspired Version. That doesn't necessarily mean that it's not an important subject, but just that we don't need to get tied up in one chapter and you know, argue to the death over these different, you know, length of times, you know, for creation. I said this insulates the restoration movement somewhat from needing to prove Genesis 1 as a scientifically accurate statement on the physical origin of the universe. We'll see. Moving on here quickly. Next question, the big question is there an absolute moral law? If there is no moral law independent of human will, how can we be certain that things are good or bad, right or wrong? And another question for the unbeliever is, why are the basic standards of morality generally recognized in most cultures around the world? Most cultures, even if they've never heard of Bible or heard of Christianity, believe that it's important to be faithful and truthful and to not murder, you know, one's own family and, you know, all the, you know, sort of basic rules of the Ten Commandments, let's say, are generally understood throughout the world, even if people have never heard of, you know, organized Christian religion. So why is that? And of course, our answer is, from Moroni 7, the Spirit of Christ is given to every man to know good from evil. But the devil persuades all men to do evil. And so there is a moral law, there is a higher law that is planted in every single person to teach them right from wrong. And then all, this is also echoed in Romans chapter 2, that says the Gentiles without the law show evidence that the law is written on their conscience. And so, this is an exact quote, but you can go back and read the whole thing, is that the Gentiles show that the law is written on their hearts. And that's, you know, that there is a moral law out there that is universal. In the end, it is faith that holds the answer to life's problems, not science. Science can tell us many things about what man has observed about nature, but it is amoral. It doesn't have morals, either good or bad. Science can't tell us how we should live or act. Science can tell us the biological effects of when someone is stabbed to death, but it cannot explain why it is wrong to murder. And so the moral question versus the biological question of how does one die are two different things. And there's nothing in the science that necessarily tells us that it's right or wrong to commit murder and to, you know, to kill innocent human beings or whatever. And I just commented that Darwin's survival of the fittest is a fundamental part of the evolutionary model. Whether it's true or not in a biological sense, it doesn't tell you whether it's right or wrong. And so how do we judge? We can't go to science, and so where do we go? The moral questions are the realm of philosophy or religion. And we believe and we hold that Christianity holds the most rational answers to these questions. What is right and wrong, and what is truth? So the big question for those outside the Christian or other faith is not how God created, but whether there is a God. And then from that, if there is a God, we must probably assume that he has some kind of moral claim upon that which he created, and that he has a moral law that we should follow. Now, it's not necessarily a guaranteed conclusion, but considering that, you know, if by reason, if somebody makes something, then they have responsibility for it, and also looking at every religion around the world, even if they hold different views on morality, they all hold the view that God has some kind of moral law. You know, if you're a Hindu, you know, you either do the karma and get to the good place, or you don't do the karma and every religion, you know, holds that there is some moral teaching by some God entity. It seems reasonable to believe that would be the case. And so then the question is, if there is a God who created us and established a moral law, what difference would it make in your life as an unbeliever? You know, if you're talking to an unbeliever, how would you live your life differently if there really were a God? On the contrary, if this life is all there is, if there's no day of no eternity, no day of judgment, no reward and punishment for our actions, why in the world would you try to even live a good life, live a righteous life? If you're going to just go down to the dirt when you're dead anyway, there is nothing after this life, what would cause anybody to be just and honest and kind and respectful of other people's life? Why should we make sacrifices to help others? Why shouldn't we just live it up, have a good time, make as much money as we can, and take advantage of others and take care of ourselves? If there's no moral law, what would keep you? And one example of this thing is, you know, the person that says there's no moral law. Well, if I take my gun and point at you and kill you, well, I'll just, you know, go ahead and do that. Oh, no, you can't do that. That's wrong. Well, how do you know it's wrong? If, you know, wrong means that there's got to be some kind of a standard. But if there is no moral standard, there's nothing wrong with me taking out a gun and killing you. And obviously that's a question that needs to be answered. But the evolutionists may say, oh, but self-sacrifice, it evolved out of our need to to perpetuate our species, because people figured out that, you know, by working together they would survive better than by competing with each other. Okay, well, if that's so, then why is there, especially in humanity, why is there so little self-sacrifice that seemed to be involved at times? And why does it take a conscious moral choice for us to sacrifice for others? You know, if self-sacrifice just evolved and, you know, that kind of thing, why do we have to choose to sacrifice for others? You know, it's a hard thing. It's not always a good thing. You know, we want to preserve our own life. It's a choice that we have to make. Why isn't it just a natural biological response that we make if it evolved biologically? You know, there's a choice involved.
By your same argument, though, with the idea of morality, it's degenerated over the years. For instance, you have organizations now that men and boys, they can have a love relationship or whatever, you know. But if you walk this backwards, you see the morality, if society is left to its own without any moral underpinning, it degenerates. And if you walk it back through these steps of evolution, like you're saying, there has to be something that would argue against an evolutionary stance.
Yeah, if self-sacrifice and altruism and those kind of things evolved and became, you know, developed over time, then why are they seem to be getting worse and deteriorating? And again, that's, I guess, you know, a good argument. Or something for to think about. So again, another question is, you say that there is no God, no eternal reward for things we do in this life. What if you're wrong?
My answer is today, what if you say there's no God and you die and there's no God, and you're right. But what if you're wrong?
Then, just to be fair, I've given the other question. Well, what if I believe that there's a God, and I believe that there's a moral standard of right and wrong, and I believe that I should do good and get rid of bad and evil, and what if I'm wrong? What if I die and I end up in the dirt and I don't wake up to find out, but I guess I realize that there isn't anything else. What if I was wrong about that? You know, how would that affect your life if you make that choice that there is no God and you live that way and you find out you're wrong versus I live that there, as if there is a God and I find out later that I'm wrong? How would that affect our, you know, the way that we live our lives?
Didn't Paul address that to some degree when he said that if there is no God, then what we have done in this life, or I forget.
Yeah, 1 Corinthians 15, that we're most miserable of all men, I think it said. Yeah. That's one answer to it, but I've got a few other answers to it or viewpoints on that, I think. So if you think that there's no God and you live that way and you find out that you're wrong, you will have spent your life on many things that are of temporary value and earn for yourself an eternity of suffering in hell. If I'm wrong, I've lived my life as, you know, doing good to other people and trying to help other people and living a righteous life as best I understand it, and I find out I'm wrong, I can die with a good conscience and, okay, well, maybe there wasn't any reward, but at least I've made the world a better place. I've tried to help others and I've tried to live in a way that would benefit others rather than just benefiting myself. You know, the consequences of my life choice, whether I'm, you know, and I'm not acknowledging that I'm wrong here, but I'm saying that if I were to live as if there was a God, I would be making a positive impact on the world because I believe that there is a right way to live and that there is a good choice, you know, good choices to be made, and that's the way I'm going to live. If you don't believe that there's a right and wrong, why would you make those right choices, which are sometimes harder because they're self-sacrifice, and, you know, why not live for yourself? And then the question again, don't you think it's important for you to find out for yourself whether God is real? Again, asking for a commitment. And again, I'm kind of trying to speed along here because we're running short on time. Would God condemn people to hell? Well, if God is such a loving God, how can he condemn people to hell that he created? Where are we? There we are. And my answers to that started with, first, the question of what God might do is irrelevant if there is no God. So refer back to the previous section. We've got to answer that question first, whether there is a God. Otherwise, you know, speculative questions about what God might or might not do don't really matter if there's no afterlife and no God. But second, if there is a self-existent creator God, it stands to reason that we have no right to tell him what he should do or what he should be and what choices that he should make. If there is a God, now that we've gotten past that discussion, you know, assuming that now that there is a God, we don't have the right to tell him, well, that's not fair, because he's God and we're not. So, you know, these hypothetical questions are hypothetical, but, you know, I want to go on and ask, you know, how do you picture God? Do you picture, if there were a God if, that you don't accept necessarily, do you picture him as a good or evil, a merciful or cruel being? You know, do you picture him as a just, or do you picture him as a tyrant? Does he punish the good and reward the evil, or does he act with justice and with you know, equity, you know, to people? You know, and these are just questions to kind of think, you know, not that, you know, if the person doesn't believe in God, well, what kind of God would you imagine if there was one? If you can imagine a God that's unjust and that would punish the good, you know, why? You know, that's a whole different question. Why do you picture that God might be like that? Let me get into other discussions. And especially the question about the justice is going to move on to the next section here. Well, our following slide, I think. Before we talk about why would God condemn people to hell, we need to talk about what hell is. And of course, the Restoration, I believe, has a more compelling worldview and an explanation on this, is that hell is not just this literal fire and brimstone that people are in. By the way, how does a spirit get tormented with literal fire? I never quite understood that. If hell is not some just fiery torture chamber by a capricious God to laugh at the sufferings of those that he hates, well, if I thought that was what hell was, then I would think, yeah, that doesn't really make sense that God would be that kind of a God. But that's not what hell is. And so that we can answer the misunderstandings and the, you know, what do you think it is versus here's what I believe it is. And it seems like a more reasonable answer that hell is a prison for violators of God's moral law, a place of correction and teaching, and a place for those who didn't know the truth in this life so that they would be given a chance for a fair judgment. And in fact, I think I had a conversation like this with a friend at work who was basically an unbeliever and, you know, shared some different things. And, you know, he had a different view of, oh, well, you know, that makes more sense than some of the other versions of Christianity that he'd seen out there that just didn't seem to be rational, let's say, and didn't seem to be fair. I think the Restoration has a better answer to these questions.
John, do you believe that the prison house and hell are different places?
I know over the years the church has kind of taught that they were the same. Yeah, the prison house and the hell were basically the same. I kind of think that's true, but I don't get too tied up in trying to, you know, prove one way or the other. That there's one experience that I've read years ago where somebody had basically gone to hell and they saw it as this long hallway where there were these rooms, you know, all the way down the hall. And in the first rooms, it was kind of like a classroom where people were being taught and things. And then you get a little further down, these people were kind of chained against their will, but they were still being taught. And then further down, they were just violent and, you know, angry and everything. And then further down the thing, there was these, you know, what would you say, you know, wailing and gnashing of teeth and kind of things, and he wasn't even allowed to go that far. And that's kind of the picture I get of hell and the prison house as being, you could kind of segregate the prison house as kind of the upper part of that spectrum, and the hell is kind of the lower part of that spectrum. But, you know, if you all picture it as it's this temporary place separate from paradise, then, you know, whether it's the same or different, I don't think it really matters too much if we understand it that way. But
now, there are some who believe that there's two places. Mm-hmm. The hell and the prison house aren't the same, and I think what you're saying there is, doesn't the scriptures also refer to a lowest hell? So that definitely depict degrees.
Degrees, yeah. Degrees or places, I don't think it really matters because you're talking spirits here. Place doesn't necessarily apply to non-physical beings, right? So I think that's probably how I'd answer that. But let's see, what did I say? So now, about why would God condemn people to hell? We might just as easily ask, how could a loving, principled judge in a human courtroom condemn a guilty man to prison? We expect judges in the human sense to condemn and punish the guilty and to let the innocent go. Why would we think God as a divine being would be any less than what we expect of human judges? So doesn't it seem reasonable that God as a divine judge would condemn the guilty to prison and let the innocent go free? I mean, you know, would we expect God to be any less than a human judge?
Are you going to roll into the idea that God isn't really condemning, but that it's a man's choice?
I don't think I got to that point, but that's another good point.
And
yeah.
You said that you can't be restored to something you couldn't tolerate. If you couldn't live that level in this world, you're not going to be restored to a level that you couldn't handle.
Right, yeah, we make the choices. You know, it's God sets the law, and we make the choice whether to live it or don't live it. And then if we don't live it, we receive the consequences. Just like if we drive too fast on the highway, we might end up wrapped around a telephone pole. Well, it wasn't the telephone pole's fault. It wasn't the car maker's fault. It was our choice, yeah. And that's, I think, another good answer. I didn't put it in here, but Christianity believes in a God who is benevolent and a just ruler, a loving father, giving grace to the righteous and punishing iniquity. Yet also one who gives forgiveness through Christ's atonement. And so again, focusing away from hell and back onto Christ, that this is where our focus of our witness is best to focus there. And I also just mentioned that the Call of Evening, of course, it's been a lot of years since I've read it, but they have a excellent discussion on this whole subject of Christ holding the keys of death and hell, visiting prison, and providing a way for those prisoners to be let go. Yeah, it gives a pretty good biblical study on a lot of these scriptures that I'm sure you're all familiar with. So next question, was Jesus just a good teacher? Well, I can accept Jesus as a good moral teacher, but you know, Confucius, Muhammad, and Jesus, you know, they were all good teachers, but I don't know if I can accept him as God, as a divine, you know, ruler. So first of all, we've got to ask, did Jesus really claim to be God? You know, before we say that, you know, that you know, we believe him, that he was God, did he actually claim that he was God? Second, we've got to look at, is the scripture reliable on this point? And third, can someone accept Jesus as a good teacher without accepting his claim to be God? And so, from the Bible, we can say absolutely Jesus did make the claim to be God. Not only did he claim to be God, but the Jews recognized that he was claiming to be God. And you can see not only from the teaching about Jesus, but the Jews' response to his teachings, that this is what he claimed to be for himself. The Jews believed that only God could forgive sins. Jesus forgave sins. The Jews got upset and all mad at him because he was trying to forgive sins that only God could forgive. They clearly understood that he was claiming to forgive as a divine being. With the idea that, you know, if someone sins against me, I can forgive them. But if someone sins against God, only God can forgive. And so that's why they believed, I think, that only God could forgive people's sins, and therefore Jesus was claiming to be that being. Jesus said, before Abraham was, I am. I am that I am. Very clear statement to a Jew that Jesus was claiming to be the one in the burning bush. He was claiming to be God. Let's see, next one. Jesus claimed oneness with the Father. He claimed to be the Son of God. The Jews said this was blasphemy. You know, thou being a man, makest thyself God. And so they understood what he was claiming by that. Jesus commanded that the people believe in God, well, believe also in me. Well, if I believe in some other man as if I believe in God, well, I'm kind of putting him up on the same level as God. Again, he was claiming identity with God and an object of belief. And finally, in John 20, Thomas called him God. You know, my Lord and my God. And Jesus didn't say, oh, no, I'm not God. He accepted that worship, and he accepted that term. And so, again, showing that the Bible, according to the Bible, Jesus was making that claim for himself. So, Jesus claimed to be God, Jesus could not falsely make these claims to godhood and still be revered as a good teacher. And this goes back to, I think, C.S. Lewis's argument, basically, that Jesus, you have three choices. Either Jesus was a liar, or he was a lunatic, or he was the Lord. What good moral teacher would purposely lie to his followers? You know, I am God, but he knew that he really wasn't God, so therefore he was lying. How can you accept Jesus as a good moral teacher if he was a liar? You know, it doesn't fit. A liar is not something you'd accept as a good moral teacher, and so you either have to accept him that he was a liar, but then you can't accept him as a good teacher. Or if Jesus thought he was God, just like a lot of people in the insane asylums think, oh, I'm Jesus Christ, or I'm a tomato, or whatever. You know, if he thought he was God, but he really wasn't, then he was crazy. He was a lunatic. And is that somebody that you'd want to accept as a good moral teacher? It doesn't fit. So the only other choice is that he believed that he was God, and that he said that he was God and really was, as opposed to not being that. And therefore, if he is God, then he is worthy of our worship. Let's see. Okay, so that was the end of that one. Through the rest in 5 minutes. Is Jesus the only way to heaven? Again, another criticism. Those who prefer other religious traditions over the claims of Christianity will say that many roads lead to heaven. As long as you believe in God and do good works, you will go to heaven. And isn't it rather exclusive and arrogant of Christianity to claim that our version of truth is the only way? And just going through several scriptures, I'm going to skip through these, that Christianity does actually claim to be the way, not just one of the ways. Jesus is the only name under heaven whereby we must be saved. And several other scriptures that I'm not going to read for sake of time. And then I say it is unfair, even though people like to beat up Christianity, oh, you're very exclusive and you're very, you know, your way, you think your way is the only way. As if we're the only ones that do that. I said it is unfair to criticize Christianity for being exclusive. Any claim of truth, anybody who says, well, this is true and these other ways aren't true, any claim of truth is exclusive of contrary claims. So it's not like Christians are being the arrogant and exclusivist ones. Anybody who claims to say this is true is saying that something else is not true, or unless they say that everything is true, and then you have just a mash of moral relativism and nothing's true at that point, maybe. Islam believes that the sole sufficient and consummate miracle of Islam is the Quran. Hinduism requires an uncompromising acceptance of the law of karma. Buddhism rejects the Hindu Vedas and its caste system, and so therefore it sets up its way as the better way, and the other is as wrong. The point being here that all religions make claims of truth that exclude other points of view. Atheism requires a rejection of the concept of God and the idea of a transcendent, eternal moral laws. So that is a claim of truth that is exclusive, because if you don't believe it, then you're obviously wrong, and you're excluded from the truth as an atheist would see it. So it's not just Christianity that believes that truth is very exclusive. Even moral relativism requires an acceptance of the view that truth is relative, determined by individual perception. Therefore, we must accept each person's viewpoint as being true for them. That is a truth claim in and of itself. If I don't believe that, well, then I'm wrong according to the moral relativists. They are making exclusive truth claims, even though they are trying to say that all truth is good. Our truth isn't good for them. And so they are being exclusive. In other words, any philosophy or truth claim is automatically exclusive of others. And so the claim that Christianity is unique in that is clearly false. Let me skip ahead just to a couple of... I've got notes back there. This one is one that I want to talk about before I quit. Is the Bible true and dependable? And I say this... the Bible, Jesus may have... It may be written in the Bible that Jesus said he was God, or written that Jesus is the only way, but how can we really depend on the Bible as being a true thing? They changed it, and they you know, people put in their own ideas and their own theories. How do we know that was really what Jesus said? Well, I say this is a tricky subject for restorationists, because on the one hand, you know, unbelievers criticize the Bible as unreliable, and it is possible for us to defend the Bible as being a very credible witness, which has a lot of manuscript and physical evidence in its favor. But on the other hand, we also know that the Bible was changed. And so we have kind of a fine line to walk. You know, we can't walk the Protestant, you know, infallible Bible road, because we know that that's not exactly the case. But we also know that it's reliable. So we have to kind of take a middle road there. And that can be kind of tricky. First of all, about the dependability of the Bible, there are thousands of manuscripts that agree, almost completely, scattered across several continents and translations into several languages. And some of these date clear back to the 3rd century, and there are even, I guess, now some fragments that go clear back earlier than that. Fragments, and meaning small portions or verses or whatever that go along with the more complete texts that we have elsewhere. There are over 5,000 manuscripts for the Bible so far identified, with only 650 manuscripts for Homer's Iliad. And the earliest manuscript for Homer's Iliad was 1,000 years after he wrote it, whereas these manuscripts for the Bible were within at least a few hundred years of when it was written. Oops. We also have contemporary accounts of Jesus and other internal evidences to show that the Bible is trustworthy. Things, you know, secular historians that wrote about this teacher Jesus being living in Palestine and at the time, who didn't have the bias of the Christian, you know, defenders of the faith. On the other hand, evidence for the fact that the Bible cannot be literally letter for letter without error is that there are thousands of Bible manuscripts which do not fully agree with each other. The very fact that you have in your footnotes of the NIV Bible, you know, some manuscripts say this, means that there were manuscripts that were changed. There had to be changes going on, and they recognized that, as much as they tried to defend the infallibility of the text. If these earliest manuscripts are correct, then the scriptures must have been changed. But if the early manuscripts are wrong, then those manuscripts were changed. You know, something. The fact that there are earliest manuscripts means that something was changed somewhere. And so we have to recognize that the possibility exists. And I do go into some, on the next slide here, there are different quotes from some of the early church fathers about the fact that the scriptures were changed. And Bob Moore has written on this. I can get you more information on that. A very complete article that he wrote talking about this. And I think I'm gonna go ahead and stop with the next slide here, which might be of interest. We get criticized because Joseph Smith wrote in the Wentworth letter, "We believe the Bible to be the Word of God as far as it is correctly translated." Oh, well, that's kind of just begging the question, and, you know, that kind of thing. It's by those who say that the Bible is infallible. Well, in 1978, the Council on Biblical Inerrancy, 300 evangelical scholars wrote this scriptural statement basically on their belief on infallibility. And one of the statements that they made was, "We further affirm that copies and translations of Scripture are the Word of God to the extent that they faithfully represent the original." Isn't that saying the same thing as what Joseph Smith said? We believe that the Bible is true to the extent that it was translated correctly. Well, Joseph is at least in good company with 300 other Bible scholars there, who were held up by the evangelical world as the council on, you know, the statement on inerrancy. I think I will, even though I'd like to go on, I'll turn it over to you here. I know you've got a few more things you wanted to talk about at the end here, but I mean, I can go longer certainly, but I do have notes for you know, on the slides and John, and a couple of other things. Yes.
Do you have enough for another class?
Oh, I don't know. I have lots more. But
I mean, like for next month is what I
mean. Probably not in what I have here, but yeah, there are surely things that we could talk about, but, you know, it might be you want to hear from somebody else next time, and, you know, maybe get somebody else's thing. I don't know. You might even want to think about it. I know that we've got the thing from the high priest that as far as fasting and prayer, I thought, well, maybe you might want to think about maybe coming next, you know, next time with, you know, and kind of in that spirit of you kind of the fasting and prayer as a quorum. But I'll do whatever you like. So, okay. Maybe it all for now. I'll do it in favor.
That's old man. Yeah.
Thank you, John. You went through a lot for us to think about.